ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys for your Friday. Of course, Monday and Friday, and after every day's play, the Ashes is done. We did our episode last night, wrapping up what was the fifth and final day of the fifth test in Sydney, Australia 4, England 1, which means we've got a bit more time today on our Friday drop to pull some broader issues apart, which is what we like to do here on the ABC Cricket Podcast. My name's Corbin Middlemass. Ed Cowan is my podcast co-host. We're in the same city still, but not in the same location, unfortunately, on this sunny Friday in the Harbour City. Teddy, good morning to you, firstly.
Good morning. You sound a little scratchy. Did you celebrate a 4-1 series win as well as the players, by the sounds of things? Or was it, are you just overworked?
I think I've just been working so hard, Teddy, that must be the reason for it as to why I'm a little scratchy this morning. So it was actually pretty tame last night. I think after Adelaide, everything's tame in that column. But had a great night with my colleagues and a few beers, and it was awesome. So
you deserved it, Corb. People don't see you working from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night, so you can let that hair down any time you want. You know what? The late daily podcast, there's been lots of feedback just flow in post series. People really enjoyed it, so I think the hard work was worth it, so I appreciate you dedicating extra little 40 minutes every day to this little podcast project.
Yeah, absolutely. It was worthwhile. I'm like you, got lots of feedback from people that were able to run into about the place, and it's privilege is all ours. We love doing it and being able to chop up what's going on the cricket field and the issues in and around the game. And it's been plenty of those, hasn't there? So if you look at the Ashes series overall, I was just going through the series and the highlights and the results and the pair of the eight wicket wins in Perth and Brisbane, and then the 82 run win in Adelaide. The Ashes were done there after 11 days. England winning by 4 wickets in Melbourne, and then a 5 wicket win for the Aussies in Sydney. So that was the results. We obviously know Mitchell Starc was the man of the series. England won 4 out of the 5 tosses, and yet Australia obviously won 4 out of the 5 games. And so then I was thinking about what were all the subplots that we had throughout the series. And it's amazing when you cast your mind back and you think, the Snicko technology that came under scrutiny in Adelaide, and that was a big story. We had obviously Matt Page doing press conferences at the completion of the MCG test, which was really unprecedented in my time covering cricket. Stuart Clark's critique here in Sydney, and then the CA ban that followed on the ABC. We had the Noosa Stag do. Khawaja's back spasms. There was so many little things that often ticks along the sports media cycle, and it felt like the Ashes was full of those. And it's amazing how these sort of things come and go, and you think about them at the time that they're that they dominate the headlines, and then in retrospect you think, oh, that's right, I remember we were discussing that at length, and all of these things have passed through the series and happened adjacent to the cricket.
Yeah, without doubt, these subplots are what people live and breathe. Particularly, I think there were probably more brought out this summer because the cricket on the field was either short or unsatisfying. We had two great tests in amongst, two decent ones and a test match that probably we've covered no end as to our views in Melbourne as to why it wasn't ideal. So I think when the cricket maybe lacks a little bit of competitive juice, and that would be a high-level view, I think England were more than competitive but didn't take their chances. But when that's the case, I think we like diving deep on all the other narratives that are built out because it keeps us interested in the game we love.
Might be one for us to pick apart too on Monday is something we can park about, I guess maybe the modern relationship between the Australian cricket team and the current players and the press. It feels like it was sort of reached a little bit of a flashpoint this week with obviously Stuart Clark's comments, but that there have been a number of little incidents throughout the series so far. So, and it probably depends how you pull that apart, whether that's something that's a one-off incident, or whether it's basically a build-up and probably a broader conversation that I think we can probably pick apart at another time. Just on the Aussie planning, and we sort of spoke a lot yesterday about credit where it's due and to give the selectors their flowers, and we had Alex Carey on post-play and spoke to him about the strategy coming up to the stumps, for example, and how well That was executed, and him being able to do it firstly is, you know, obviously plays a huge role, but it also really brought guys like, you know, Nisa and Boland into the series in a way that perhaps, you know, otherwise they wouldn't have been as effective against this version of the England team. And then the problems that they had to overcome along the way. So, you know, 16 different players used, really not a whole lot from Pat Cummins. He played the one test with, you know, Lyon likewise, and Josh Hazlewood obviously missing completely. So, that was a couple of bold calls, wasn't it, to leave out spinners on certain occasions. And in the end, they get it done by committee, and it's the result sort of speaks for itself.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the strength of the planning and execution of the team. I don't think they won this series how they thought they were going to. If you were to say Boland and Nisa were both going to play integral roles and 30% of their overs are going to be with Alex Carey up to the stumps, I would have probably laughed at you. You know, the mindset coming in would have been Hazlewood, Cummins, Stark, we're going to beat them, with traditional Australian high-quality fast bowling. But in actual fact, we beat England probably at, you know, a style of cricket that they're probably more akin to playing, and that is, you know, fast mediums. You know, Boland's a bit faster than that, but Nisa certainly isn't. And, you know, Richardson was low 130s. By the end of the series, Boland, you know, mid 130s, Doggett 130s. And so the style of play, and no spinner, the style of play was more akin to that, you know, county grind that you kind of see week in, week out in England, of guys going to work and being thoughtful and tactical around how they're going to prize players out. And of course, that's coupled with England's brand of cricket that at the start was all out attack, and by the end it actually retreated right back to a more controlled and more thoughtful approach, and really brought them into the last two contests with that. So, you know, it's fascinating to look back what our expectations were and what we actually got, and maybe that mismatch in expectations and output is why we're probably all feeling a little. You know, it was a great series. It was a great series because it was the Ashes, but on the field, you're kind of struggling to think of it as a great series, and maybe that's because our expectations were so mismatched to what we got.
I went back and listened to our post-play wash-up last night, and I often do this because when you're down there, there's so much going on, and so you're listening and you're also keeping one eye on what's coming next and what time we've got to be out, and there's so much happening, and it's sort of a sensory overload when you're down there on the field at the end of an Ashes series. And so I was listening back to Marnus Labuschagne and Travis Head speak to us last night, and they both addressed obviously not playing the spinner in Sydney and the reasons around it. And Marnus Labuschagne said, look, a spinner would have been great, no doubt, on days 4 or 5, if you can guarantee that they're going to make 500 in the first innings and basically gets to that point. And so I think there was and it's sort of like the two things almost contradict each other, where, you know, and Travis Head even said as much, that, you know, we decided to prioritise the batting. And so even to have, you know, 70-odd runs, not out the contribution from Bo Webster. And so it kind of made me feel a little bit, it's like, to ensure they got, you know, the big score that they needed in the first innings to bring the spinner into play, they had to play the extra batting, which took the place of the spinner in the lineup, which you'd probably think, well, maybe they're not getting enough production then out of the guys who are batting to actually bring the spinner into the game. Whereas there was this feeling, well, why would we carry someone for 3 days when the test might not last that long just to bring them into the contest in days 4 and 5? So I was interested to hear the way that they sort of spoke through it, which clearly gave us an insight into the conversations that they were having in the dressing room as to, you know, the lead up and ultimately, you know, the move that they made not to play a frontline spinner.
Yeah, that's pretty left of field thinking on a couple of different levels, and you're right, my mind directly goes to, well, it feels like not enough accountability on the top order. There were 200 makers, and that extra 70 runs without that extra batter can very easily be made up by Steve Smith or Travis Head, you know, getting big daddy hundreds and you know, 200 plus and making sure on a flat wicket that they are accountable for those extra runs that are needed, knowing that the spinner has been picked. So it felt like a little bit of a retrospective cop-out, if you ask me. Just here, that's the first time I've heard the comments. I think they probably would have loved a spinner on, you know, earlier than that. Yes, it was turning big on, you know, late day four, but just to provide some variation during that first innings, and even, you know, earlier in the second innings. So I think a good spinner would have provided a role more than turning the ball square and wickets. You know, if you think of great spinners in the first innings, often their job is defensive. And so they allow the fast bowlers go to work with more destruction, if you will, or more ability to, you know, attack at certain points in time as opposed to grinding away. So you don't have Nisa and Boland grinding away. You have your spinner, and then we can use their skills accordingly. And in many respects, Michael Nisa almost played the role of the spinner in that first innings. And, you know, that was his role in the team, and he did it well. Is that the best function for him? Probably not. Maybe given the conditions, it kind of worked. But is that the type of cricket that the Australian cricket team want to be playing? I don't necessarily know. He certainly didn't let anyone down, and he did his job. But, you know, if you could kind of, with a fresh sheet of paper, what is the best team on this wicket at this point in time and the roles they're going to play, that probably isn't it.
You asked me leading into the Sydney Test match about, you know, our satisfaction levels for the series, and I think as you spoke to, and Michael Vaughan mentioned it last night as well, that, you know, maybe it wasn't one of the highest quality Ashes series of all time, but it feels like that the Sydney Test saved it a little bit, didn't it? That we needed of 5 days of cricket, we got it. It sort of, you felt a little bit flat coming out of Melbourne, 18 days out of 25 in the end. Did we get out of it okay in the end with two short Test matches and 2 5-day tests?
Yeah, well, we got out of it okay. I think if Sydney was a 2.5 or 3-day test like it was last year, I think we'd all be feeling very flat, even if the entertainment was high. Well, I said at the time, after day two, it might have been day three, it was one of the most enjoyable days cricket I've had at a ground. You know, to have the volume of people there, the atmosphere, you know, the byplays, the hundreds, the wickets, it was an excellent Test match. And so I think that dragged it from where we were feeling after Melbourne, which was deeply unsatisfied with the Boxing Day Test, and that was, you know, reflecting very poorly on the series given what had gone before it. All of a sudden we're talking about all the great moments, and Melbourne feels the afterthought. It was like we had two great Test matches, two pretty good Test matches, and Brisbane was probably better than pretty good. It was probably closer to great than pretty good. Perth had an incredible day's cricket, and probably my series highlight came in Perth, and then you have the aberration of Melbourne.
Yep.
And so I think we were well above the line in terms of you know, where the series falls.
Adelaide 1, Sydney 2, Brisbane 3, Perth 4, Melbourne 5?
Yeah, I think that's a fair summation. I think Perth was a better test. Maybe it was a better day's cricket than we remember. But I think as an overall test, I think that's a fair summation. I think Daylight was actually fifth, and then Melbourne.
That's
Country Mile, and then Melbourne at seven.
Yeah, there was. I was about to say whatever the margin was. It's I'd have been at 10 mil was the difference between maybe Melbourne and.
That's good.
18 days of cricket of the Ashes all done and dusted. One thing that's the gift that keeps on giving in the holiday season is the England cricket team. And I woke up this morning and reading all the press, and Harry Brook, who's the white ball captain and the vice captain, obviously, of the Test team, is all of a sudden in the headlines. It reads as follows. Vice captain Harry Brook has been involved in an altercation with a bouncer at a nightclub in New Zealand the night before one of their one-day internationals in a tour that preceded the Ashes. He was reprimanded as a result, £30,000 fine as a result from ECB Cricket. It's another subplot to a tour which has, you know, many overlapping threads. What do you make of this when you hear it? And there's been adjacent to that, there's an ECB review which has started, and we love when a review gets down in professional sport into the series defeat and the performance of the team.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to even think about this. I mean, part of me thinks, you know, the poor guy was just acclimatizing day night cricket. You got to make sure that your body clock's, you know, working in the right direction for you. And less facetiously, I'm definitely thinking, as the captain of the team on a tour where you're having it handed to you, that isn't the cultural standard you want to be setting. So I'm surprised it's taken this long to come out, to be honest. I think the fine was probably as hefty as possible could be handed down, and you know, he's not setting the standard as the captain. This is someone who has an incredible future ahead, but captaincy isn't about what you do on the field. It's the standards you set off the field and the culture that you want the team to live by, and this falls well short of that. So
yeah,
you know, it's I can't believe it took five tests. Someone was holding on to that.
Interestingly, you know, that the Noosa Stag Do, as it was dubbed in retrospect, was booked a year out. And I know you spoke to Richard Thompson the other day, and he says, look, that the Wacker wasn't offered to them. You know, whether they could have made, you know, moves earlier to basically ensure that they had, you know, premier venues, and now obviously we know there's going to be a new agreement in place between the ECB and Cricket Australia to make sure for both visiting teams in Ashes series that more is to be done in the lead up to yeah, have better preparation essentially and get what they want in the lead up to the first test. But I don't know, does it speak to you know, a broader drinking culture in the sport, whether it's golf or, you know, or drinking? And I mean, it is very different to other sports. Like, I know, mate, I cover a lot of, you know, Australian rules football, and the guys, yeah, aren't allowed to play golf the day before a match for the fear that they might get injured. And then when it comes to drinking, I mean, yeah, Aussie rules players have pretty much go the whole year without having a beer. I mean, they're finely tuned athletes. You can see that they look like, you know, Olympic sprinters, most of them, in their body shape. In a way, cricket, you know, you think in 2026, it doesn't have the same, you know, professional standards physically, at least, than what of a lot of other sports do. And at the top level, where, you know, a lot of these guys are, you know, really highly paid, it's bizarre to think that, you know, the night before a game, you know, anyone, much less the captain, you know, is out having a few drinks before the game starts.
Yeah, I'm going to push back on probably most of the things you just said then. You know, the physicality of bowling fast in Test match cricket matches any AFL that you've ever seen, and I've never seen a fast bowler successfully have a lengthy Test career and enjoy a beer too much. You know, I disagree. I think that there is some nuance around cricket about long tours. So Harry Brooks been on tour now for 4 months. At some point in time, you need some outlet, be it golf or a beer, and yeah, it's all done in moderation and at the right time. There are other issues in AFL, like, you know, I'm sure illicit substance abuse that you know, might fill that void and doesn't exist in cricket. So there's still very much a change room culture. Yes, alcohol plays a role in that, but I think in professional cricket, given the 12-month nature of it, and there's no off-season per se for a lot of these players, that they need to find moments to decompress. Now, that should be done in moderation, just like a game of golf or a glass of wine or whatever that is for the player. When it starts getting excessive, the night before a game, unacceptable. Golf 3 days running, you know, before a test match that results in you getting injured, is unacceptable in my mind. So we can disagree with certain things, but things done to excess generally are not good for anyone. But you're going to have to find, otherwise your performance starts to wane pretty quickly. You got to find ways to be able to get yourself out of the touring bubble, otherwise your mental health can struggle as well.
Yep, and I agree with that. I mean, I don't have any issue with the guys having a beer after the game or whatever it turns out to be, but yeah, it's pretty rare that you see any professional sportsman, and to be fair, I probably think a lot of cricketers wouldn't be drinking the night before a game.
Well, hang on, 99, this is what correct. I'm saying, this is a real outlier, and that's okay. What makes it worse, and the fact that he was the captain. So drinking the night before a game.
Yeah, and he wasn't on tour for a long time at that stage. You know,
no, I understand that. I'm just saying generally, and that example is so far from how most cricketers would prepare for an international game of cricket.
Does it put extra pressure on Rob Key and Brendan McCullum? I mean, they've known about it for a long period of time, and they probably feel like they've dealt with it. I saw Matt Roller on ESPN Crick Info talk about the fact that, you know, what is the case for McCullum at this stage, other than the fact that he's contracted for 2027? Since taking over all formats, the results have been poor. Against India and Australia, he's had two drawn series, both at home, 2-2, and he's lost both of their away series against the same opponents, 4-1. So the results
have they been poor? He took over a team that couldn't spell the word win, and has transformed and brought on players like Jacob Bethel and, you know, Tung. Like, so they have found some players in this period of time. Would someone else have done it better? I don't know. Who would take his job? I think it's a little bit of a poison chalice at this point in time. I think what it should be, if they are serious about moving this team forward, a wake-up call. And that is rebasing whatever Bazball stands for. And it started off as a means of putting pressure on the opposition and turned into an all-encompassing, you know, almost cult-like attitude to attacking at all costs. And so it shifted very quickly to something that became unsustainable. And in actual fact, we've seen their best cricket being played with a balance between where they started, which is at the right time being able to exert pressure. Where I think it lets itself down is probably around the discipline of certain aspects of the game, like fielding. So, you know, this is, you know, talent-wise, a pretty decent fielding team between Crawley, you know, Duckett dropped a heap of catches, but can, you know, he's a wicketkeeper who can actually field. Harry Brooks, a gun fielder. Bethel's a gun fielder. They dropped twice as many catches as the Australians. So discipline, and that shows up off the field, whether you're drinking the night before a game, doing the one percenters around fielding, doing the one percenters around recovery. All their fast bowlers are no longer here. And so that being able to move on a sliding scale from attack at all costs, we're here to have fun, to actually we're here to win, what's it going to take, and a little bit more discipline around those two. And, you know, look no further than the Australian team that manages those particular issues really well.
I think Michael Vaughan had a line where he said, you know, this England team, they don't like the one percenters, and you just referenced it similarly there in the way that they go about it, and that's that there's a bit to be said about that. I mean, he took over the dual roles when Matthew Mott left in September 2024, and since then, yeah, even in Test cricket, they've lost as many games as they've won. So in that period of time, it's, you know, the trend line's not overly crash hot, but at least they got the little hopeful upswing with obviously Bethel's performance here. And yeah, you get the feeling what they're going to move a lot of pieces around him, aren't they? And essentially, McCullum will stay, and there'll be a bit of a clean out when it comes to the assistants, and basically try and get some new ideas in and see whether he's, you know, how he's going to go accepting maybe new ideas and being able to, and what that looks like.
I think that's the key point, because I think the feedback that I've heard is that he's surrounded himself with yes people who aren't willing to challenge, or when they do challenge, it's not met with the right curiosity that a leader should probably meet that with. And so, you know, I'm sure Brendan McCullum, if he is reflecting appropriately, he's got some challenges as a coach that need to be addressed. That's not just a playing issue. And so if he's willing to improve and change his style, then I think they can be set up for success. But if he's not, then it's up to Rob Key to actually, you know, put the foot down and say you need to change or you need to go. And that's a conversation I don't know he's necessarily willing to take. I guess where my mind goes is all these comments that we make now, they're going to be a different team in 2027 in England, and Australia will probably look slightly different as well. And so there's a world where, you know, we're made to eat our words pretty quickly. 18 months is only a short period of time away.
All right, that gets me to my my next point that I was about to make. I feel like we need to get a little bit of pace here on the show. And so what I wanted to do is go through these teams, and I want you to tell me who you think's likely to make it in 2027 to the Northern Ashes and who isn't. So first of all, Crawley.
Toss of the coin.
Duckett.
Yes.
Bethel.
Absolutely.
Joe Root.
Yes.
Brook.
Yes.
Stokes.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Will Jax.
Not unless he decides to score some runs.
Cass.
Probably not.
Potts.
I think in England would be pretty effective.
Tung.
Yes.
Archer.
No.
Wood.
No.
Pope.
No.
Bashir.
don't know. I think they're going to have to find a spinner, without doubt.
All right, the Aussie boys. So, Head, obviously. Yes. Weatherald?
Undecided, probably not.
Labuschagne?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Kawaja? Oh, Kawaja's gone, we know that. Carey? I'm just going through the batting order. Alex Carey?
Yes.
Cam Green?
He'll make the Ashes.
Webster?
Yes.
Ooh, Nisa?
Probably not.
Stark?
Yes.
Boland?
50-50.
Cummins?
Yes.
Richardson?
No.
Lyon?
No.
Doggett?
No.
And Inglis?
No.
Okay. There you go. That's a quick little hit, yes or no, on what these teams look like going forward. It's going to be fascinating to see how much stays the same and how much changes. So when we sit here, I mean, maybe the last 11 is going to be a little bit of a interesting tell, given that they always look a bit weird, that the two squads for the final test in Sydney at the end of a long series. And I think when we look back on these scorecards in years to come, you think, gee, they have odd looking makeups, with the all rounder all the way down the bottom, and even more so with obviously the night watchman in position. But whose team do you think will change more out of between now and those Ashes? Like, would
I think Australia will change more?
Okay, yeah.
As a thought experiment.
Yeah,
I think England, they're younger on the way up, and Australia, facing a potential cliff that they might fall off.
I think it's a fascinating run ahead to the next Ashes series, because I look at it and I think, where's the off ramp? Like, if you're playing and
it was yesterday.
Correct. If you're playing, there's no test cricket now until August. So it feels like if you get on the roller coaster in August, you're playing two against Bangladesh, you're going straight to South Africa in October for three test matches in this redemption tour.
There's all sorts of people out there, Corb. Okay. You don't just turn up in South Africa and middle your way through a series. You got to be absolutely world-class to perform over there. And there's a world where we get ambushed and, it exposes a whole range of issues that forces Australia, and the team to address that before they kind of hit the home summer, etc. So I think there's a bit of a forcing function there.
And then the Kiwis, obviously, for four test matches at home, it's a bit of a softer series that, New Zealand have always struggled in these parts in test cricket. And then after that, you think, well, if I'm still playing in the Australian cricket team, we're about to go to India. This is a banner tour overseas, five test matches there. Come back, play the anniversary test. You would think, oh, well, ordinarily, that might be a nice point to exit and, the day-night test at the MCG. But you think, hang on, if I just get through this, I'm going to England. There's an Ashes tour that's, right around the corner in the winter of 2027. So it's an interesting time to be on board in the test team.
18 months is a long time in international cricket. That's all I know. But, and so with a lot of cricket on, I think it's silly to think that things will stay the same.
All right, let's review our prediction. So where Teddy was right.
I've been waiting for this.
Where Teddy
Josh
was right.
Josh Hazlewood was the leading wicket taker for the series, wasn't he? With a total of, hang on, checks notes, zero.
So here we go. Where Teddy was right, where Teddy was wrong. Listen back to our episode from November 17. And if you think we're just making all this up, you can actually go back and do that too in the podcast feed and go back and hear what we said back at that particular time. So we started off by looking at our leading wicket taker and leading run scorers. So you had Hazlewood, I had Stark. Tick for me, cross for you. Leading run scorers, we both had Steve Smith, and I had a little slash saying if it's not Smith, it'll be Marnus. Really, it wasn't either of those guys, was it? Travis Head, obviously, was, as you said yesterday, 30% more runs than anyone else. We both had a 3-1 scoreline, so that was a bit boring. And in the end, we were obviously one short for the Australians. Well, I ran through the two teams before the series started and basically said, hey, who would you pick out of the openers? Would you rather the Aussie openers or the England openers? You took the England openers. Obviously, back then, no one had any idea that Travis Head was ultimately going to open the batting. But, it's interesting. When I saw the BBC readers, they put together their combined 11, so you actually got to vote on who you think would make the combined 11. And all these teams had Zach Crawley in it. And I did this on air with Darren Lehman the other day, and you can imagine his reaction. He was like, oh, how can I have Crawley average 27 or whatever? And you think, well, he's also still in the top six run scorers in the series or whatever. Like, it feels a bit gross doing it. But it was that kind of series. There wasn't a boatload of runs on offer.
No, there weren't. As I said yesterday, never has a wicket come more easily, it feels like, than this series. It feels a bit icky saying Zach Crawley's in the combined 11. Can we not move someone up? You know, can't Steve Smith open? Or, you know, that's happened in the past, hasn't it?
Can't we just pick our best six batters?
Perfect. Let's pick our best six batters and then work out the order from there.
All right, number three, so Marnus Labuschagne and Ollie Pope. I remember reading this out, and before I'd even got the question out, you said, Marnus, you said Pope doesn't last the series, and so there's a big tick for Teddy there. You're right about that.
In a combined 11, you say Jacob Bethel plays and Marnus opens? Like, yeah. Wouldn't you do it that way?
This is separate. This was, you know, the start of the series is leading in. We'll get to the combined 11 on the way out. Smith versus Root, you said, look, I'll take Smith. You know, Root's a great player but doesn't get to bat at number four on a head-to-head basis. At the end of it, did Root have a better series than Smith? 200s versus one?
Yeah, one test, four. I'm taking Smith.
Yep, okay. And caught everything, by the way. You know,
everything.
Jason Gillespie talks about, you know, he catches pigeons. That's what he does, Steve Smith. He's in that category. Travis Head versus Harry Brook, you took. Travis Head, you said, I think Brook's in for a big summer, but Head to break the shackles. And by the way, when you said that leading in, Travis Head had like one score over 40 in his last like 20-something hits, so he wasn't carrying great form in. I think even on that episode, I played a clip from Ryan Harris, who spoke and said, look, we had him for one game at South Australia. I think he probably needed two. And we thought, oh, maybe he's going in a little underdone. He's played too much white ball cricket. But I'm giving you a tick again there, Teddy, that for your Travis Head comment. So you got that one right. Green versus Stokes. You said, I'll take Green. Stokes is on the decline. He's not seeing out the whole series with his bowling loads. And he played every test, but interestingly, he was banged up at the end. Ultimately, he broke down. He wasn't able to bowl at the end of it.
Okay, I'm fair to say I got that one wrong.
Carey and Smith. You said Carey very quickly. He said he could well be the MVP of the series. And, you know, if it wasn't for a sensational series from Travis Head or Mitchell Starkey, he well would have been in the conversation.
This is the problem with a wicketkeeper as man of the series. You have to do something absolutely spectacular with the bat, because you could make a pretty decent claim, even with Stark and Head series, that Alex Carey was as impactful as both those players. So scored a fantastic 100 in Adelaide. His keeping was better than exemplary. It was outstanding. You've already talked on this episode, and as we have all summer, around, you know, the tactic of him keeping up to the stumps. And so if he was read out as player of the series, it would require some nuance to your thinking, but I wouldn't have blinked, for the record. Would not have blinked. I would have gone, deserved winner.
And then Archer Wood, Cass Atkinson versus Stark, Doggett, Boland, Lyon. You took the England bowlers, saying, look, I'll give them the nod without Hazelwood.
As a group.
We did it as a group. And you said, I'll take those. I'm giving you a cross there.
That's unfair, because that group lasted 1.5 seconds.
That's the game. Here we go.
To be fair, the Australian group also lasted about 2.5 seconds as a group.
I've got some more here that you got right. So then I basically gave you a series of over and unders, which you loved this exercise when I gave you the little half ones, and you mocked it the whole way through. But you got a few of these right, so maybe you'll change your tone. First of all, Harry Brook, average of 30. And you quickly corrected me and said, 30. Of course he's going to go over 30. I said, I'll take the unders. And you said, I'll even give you 35 as a result. In the end, he averaged 39 for the series. So big tick to you. And I owe you some Indian on the back of that. So
there we go.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
I took the unders. You took the overs. And
I'm going to say that's the lowest series average he has in his career in Australia.
Okay. Wow.
Let's make a long-term bet.
Yep. I like it. There's lots of Indian over a long period of time. Pat Cummins, 2.5 tests, over or under. You took the unders, so you're on the money there. Usman Khawaja, over or under 4.5 tests. You took the
unders.
Over. You took the over. And I said to you at the time, and I listened back to it this morning, I said, oh, look, he's at an advanced stage, form lines, everything else. You know, there's a chance that, you know, he doesn't make it through. We both took the overs, and we thought, oh, he's going to play the whole way through. And in the end, he missed one. He ended up with, so you got it wrong.
I mean, my mind was, we played in he played in Adelaide and he was meant to be dropped. He did play five, and then I was like, oh, of course, he missed Brisbane with his back spasms.
Yes.
Batting in the nets, day one.
And then Joe wrote, over under 1.5 hundreds. You said under. You said, I think you'll get one, but I don't think you'll get multiples. And ultimately, that only changed right at the end. So he
I
just
think pink ball hundreds, they're worth half, aren't they?
maybe it's a push. It's right on 1.5. All right, before we get out of here, the BBC Sport readers picked their combined 11. So this is, you know, at post-series, I want to hear your response to any of this. They voted Travis Head opening the batting, no surprise. Mm-hmm. What I am surprised about, you got 91% of the vote. What are those other 9% voting on? How can 9% of people not have him in their team?
I think it actually makes the other 10 places null and void because clearly they have no idea what they're talking about.
81% of the vote for Zach Crawley, so he's opening with him. And then it's Steve Smith at 3, Root at 4, Brooke at 5. Stokes got 70% of the vote. Maybe there's a very British audience at number 6. He averaged 20 for the series. Bowled his heart out. He's a warrior, but he's listed at number 6. Carey got 97% of the vote. He's the keeper. Again, what are the other 3% doing? Mitchell Starc got 98% of the vote, which is the most. Again, how did 2% of people not have him in the 11? And true to the series that it was, it's a four-pronged pace attack. So Starc, Archer, Boland, Tongue. It feels like there's a lot of a British lean on all of this, but what do you make of that combined 11?
Yeah, there's some donkey votes evidently in there. I mean, I think Archer, geez, I'm struggling to put Archer in the combined 11. I would have thought Michael Nice's, you know, series probably nudges him out, maybe, from a longevity point of view, from a role, you know, impact, etc.
If we're putting Archer in too.
And Jacob Bethel got 100 and Zach Crawley didn't. I know it's kind of like for like, but I'd probably find a spot for Bethel as well.
If we're putting guys in too that didn't play the whole series or limited sample size, and why not put Pat Cummins in?
Cummins. came in, got Rudy destroyed them. Yeah, there we go. He's in the combined 11 instead of Archer.
Yep. So that's there you go. That's how it all panned out. That's just about our predictions done. We will be back on Monday, won't we? What day of the week is it? Friday.
Friday.
I always say this. I feel like when a test match happens, whatever the days of the week are, I look at day one as Monday and day two is Tuesday, and it's like a normal working week for me. The BBL continues. I just want a little shout out to Ollie Peake, who obviously hit the six off the last ball, ran on the other side of it to a ball outside off stump and whacked it over fine leg for six. I mean, we're going to be talking about this teenager for a long time to come. He arrived in his Renegades gear with his Renegades bag. He left in a Cricket Australia polo and had his Cricket Australia bag and was flying out to the Under-19s World Cup to lead the team. So if ever there was a mic drop in the tournament where basically he hits the six and then walks out and says, right, I'll leave you to it, guys. I'll catch you on the other side of it. So good luck to the Under-19s over at the World Cup.
They've got a big fixture against Japan coming up. So, Ollie Peake from playing at Optus Stadium hitting a six is going to find himself in the back channels of Namibia or somewhere.
Japan's got a lot of scouting to do. Imagine the Japanese scouts sitting down watching the...
I do think maybe it's one for Monday, but, you know, the top three finds of the Big Bash, because I've been watching a bit of Joel Davies tear it apart as well, thinking, oh, he's gonna be a cricketer.
I feel like Greg Shepherd's listening to this podcast and basically thought, you know what, who's this mug sportscaster that's trying to tell me what about Joel Davies? He's going down the batting order. He's not going up. I saw last time he's listed at number 8. I wanted him to bat higher. He's all of a sudden, Shippy's like, you know what, you're not telling me what to do. Comes out, bowled superbly last night. But, he's not getting any higher in that Sixers batting lineup despite them winning last night. We're reaching a good stage of the tournament, aren't we? So most teams have played somewhere around 6 or 7 games. You got to play 10 round-robin games. Yeah, there we go.
6 or 7.
Oh, no. Playoff begins January 20. It's 1v2, 3v4. So that's how the system will work when we get to the playoffs. And then obviously 1v2 is the major final, major semi. Winner goes straight through to the final, and then a repercharge for the loser up against the winner of 3-4. Teddy, loved it as always. Thank you for your insights here on the ABC Cricket Podcast. I will chat to you on the other side of the weekend.
See you Monday.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.